recording people at this time. For me, and I believe for most Southerners, the most magical of all musical sounds is the many-voiced humming of a lining hymn that arises during quiet moments in the Black Folk Service. After a song has been sung and shouted clean through and the church is resting, after a peek in the sermon, when a sinner has come through for the Lord, after the deacon has prayed and led the first hymn and everyone is thinking about what will come, then this silvery humming begins among the women like the wind faintly stirring the water. Some older sister in the back sets the sharp metronome of her toe, rapping out a quick staccato beat that will set the tempo for everything that will follow. Against it, the strong, sorrowing current of the church house moan moves like the tide of life itself, and the Southerner feels the presence of his ancestors from Senegal, from Skye, from Guinea, from Galloway. This is the old woman's wordless blues, the sound of a woman alone in the kitchen rocking a hurt child. So it's not the real service part of the church. It's what comes sort of in between the cracks.
Calling it
church house moan, I guess you call it. It's something that we don't have at our vesper service, but maybe it could be a comment on last night's. And I apologize for the needle. It's kind of fuzzy, so it doesn't pick up all the sound. Fun to listen to one song or one particular message coming out a whole bunch of different ways. One of the easiest ways to see this is to listen to another culture. So this morning for your second free write, we're going to listen to two versions of the same song, which is a Russian folk song called The Moon Shines Bright. The first version is played by a Russian balalaika orchestra. Balalaika, they're strummed instruments of all different sizes, soprano, tenor, alto, bass, etc. And they're playing this with Andreev, who's a Russian composer, his variations. Then you're going to hear another form of this Russian folk song done in a totally different style. Same piece, but I think your reaction to it will be different because of the form in which it comes.
So, what's the name?
The Moon Shines One and The Moon Shines Two.
Radio Orchestra playing Andreev's variations on the folk song, The Moon Shines.
feelings that you have to this version of the Moonshines compared to the second one.
Selection 31, the Leningrad Dixieland Band playing variations on the Russian folk song, The Moon Shines.
That people have put in you to say what maybe you're going to be or something like that, like maybe your parents have or a sister or something. And just go with it. And it speaks.
That's a really good message on letting other people be who they are too, and not trying to shape them into what you think or what should be done.
Also, has a message of letting yourself be who you are. Don't try to tell yourself anything.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit, Kyle?
Like, Goldman had such a terrific difficulty realizing that he wasn't cut out to be a monk, but he kept trying to push himself forward to that, and he was doing a very good job of pushing himself, excelling at the school, at the monastery, and such. Yet, it wasn't his heart, it wasn't his emotions or whatever. His whole body wasn't into it. Therefore, he could never truly be successful or good at it.
Who was he doing it for?
Doing it for his father.
And then? In other words, even though you may love, doing something for the sake of love is a good way to lose yourself as opposed to finding yourself. I guess that was a heavy statement. What are some of your other responses to the book?
Lights liked it.
That was a dark moment.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because at the beginning he's doing everything for his father, and later it seems like he's doing everything for the sake of him.
So there seems to be one of the themes of the book is the father-ish and mother-ish sort of sides that seem to portray. What else?
He seems to be thinking of all the women. He thinks of them as being like him. He doesn't accept that they could be like Narcissus. It just seems that, you know, women are women, and, you know, the only thing that really they're for is, you know, the kind of love that he's always seeking. And like Lydia, it just didn't seem to, you know, it was hard for him to grasp that there was something, you know, besides just the physical, or maybe not necessarily physical, but more spiritual, nonverbal.
Good point about how women are portrayed in the book.
It seems really weird to me that he can go from almost one extreme to the other with the girls. I mean, not being with them at all, and then feeling so free about it and not worrying about it, not seeming to... I don't know, it just always surprises me to be, you know, locked up in the, you know, plan your life this way, and then, you know, a couple of days later, all of a sudden, you're out and doing, you know, it just seems...
Perverse, huh?
Yeah.
Life is interesting, isn't it? This is a book that I think stirs up an awful lot of mud at the bottom, and I'm sort of curious to know what kind of muddy waters have sort of been stirred up by reading it for some of you guys. It is a rather provocative book. Yeah, Kristen?
Immediately identify with Goldman because, you know, you talk about being somebody you're not, and I kind of recognize myself as the artist trying to be a thinker, and I don't know if that's true or not, so I'm kind of... I'm wondering right now, I'm in the wonder stage. You know, I'm wondering, am I really an artist trying to be a thinker, or am I really a thinker thinking I may be an artist? You know, do you kind of see where I go?
Yeah.
So I'm sitting here going back and forth going, this is really interesting stuff. So, and the more I put myself into Goldman, the more he kept doing things, and I kept saying, gosh, I can relate this thing to things I do, you know? Or he talked about that evil thing inside of Goldman, you know, he just felt so, always so, there's something, just that empty piece missing. And I kind of sometimes feel like that. I mean, I know you guys have all felt like that. Anyway.
Just as a style point, I like the book well enough, but there's just something about it that I don't love this book. I guess I feel like Hess goes, like, I feel like the entire book has been the back of the book where he says, two medieval men, one quietly content, and he says, Goldman is the feminine part of the mind and he is sensual, instead of showing, I mean, and eventually he starts to show it, but especially through the first 60 pages of the book or so, I didn't really like reading it because I thought it wasn't well written and everybody else has gone, wow, this book is so great, I'm really into it, and then so well written, I was going, it's okay. I mean, it's easy enough to read, but I thought it was so blunt. I mean, he could have just as easily shown us that instead of saying, these are what I'm going to call the characteristics, he could have let us picture them in our minds.
You mean what he called them in the back?
In through the whole book, I get this feeling that he's saying, I don't know, there's just something, for me, there's something, the way the style is.
He's not subtle, is what you're saying.
No, not, because I think you can be real obvious without saying, you know, I mean, it's fine if you can figure out real easily what they are, but I don't like having a paragraph that says, this is Narcissus, he is a monk, he is analytical. He, you know, he has this talent and that talent, instead of obviously showing us.
I think I know what you mean, because I kind of felt that way too, that I guess I would have, to me it seems more inner than outer, I guess, in a way, in the sense that they tell us their thoughts and things, but I wish he would let us get to know the characters more through their experiences and their actions. How they relate with other people, not just with each other. We kind of do that, but I guess not enough to really see clearly for all the time. I guess maybe, is that what you're kind of saying?
Yeah, something like that.
I thought the first, like, 60 pages or whatever were more to show their relationship, because then the next page is the whole middle section is all Goldman. Then in the end, they come back, and if you don't have it set up and understand their relationship at the beginning, the end doesn't.
It's just the style point.
Well, one thing that I would ask you to think about, and we'll talk about it, if not today, then tomorrow, is that maybe this was done on purpose. And if it was done on purpose, what might the reason be? Kind of ruminate on that. Well, I think you had your hand up in there.
Well, I just was going to say, it reminded me of when I was a senior in high school, our English teacher had us do every day, and I didn't like them, but there were exercises where she would give us like one thing. She would say, okay, write about your room, your messy room at home. And she'd want you to get to be able to write it showing us about your room instead of telling us. And just the way, if I understand it correctly, that Chris was talking, that's what he was doing for a while, is telling instead of showing. Mm-hmm. And I remember it took a while to get into the feel of being able to show. And I don't know if I can remember right away how to start doing it, but yeah, it just triggered that.
Yeah.
And it makes a difference. Really.
Another thing, the characters are so rigid and so driven by fate. They don't have any room to do anything else. He makes it seem like every single thing they do is the exact next step toward what they're supposed to be doing. And, you know, they're so... Narcissus is completely, you know, analytical, and Goldman is completely, you know, the feminine side, and there's just so little crossover. I mean, there's a little bit. I mean, Goldman is good in Latin, and Narcissus is good at reading people. But other than that, it's just so rigid. It's just almost, you know, what you expect as far as I've read.
You have to be masculine to be a thinker and feminine to be artistic. Is that just the way it is?
Is it?
I don't think so.
How do you think it is?
Well, I think that this book's really sexist. I mean, it's saying that the feminine way of being is creative and feeling and stuff, and I think that's kind of the old stereotype that we're leaving that more and more, and more men are being more feeling.
But I think it has to do with it's not feminine, female, masculine, male. It's it's two different poles that of being, and it doesn't mean that women are always more sensitive. And that's kind of bad in the book. But I think what it's saying is that there can be this mix, and feminine is more just a mode instead of a sex.
So Goldman's a man, not a woman. He's feminine. So I don't know, I don't think he's sexist.
Do you have your hand up?
No, just the same thing they're saying, that it's names they give him, feminine, masculine, like we're talking. Beginning of the class, we looked at the art and at the pyramids and at the fertility gods and things like that. They were feminine and masculine. And there weren't, it wasn't our way of thinking of the sexuality connected with it. It's more of a idea or a process.
I kind of agree with Christina a little bit more. I think the book does really maybe play into some stereotypes. I mean, I think that because when I think Narcissus, I think of this tall, dark, very staunch figure, whereas they portray Goldman as a more feminine type figure with blonde hair and curly hair. And I think I can see the stereotype getting blonde. Mm-hmm.
I would think that he probably did that on purpose, because we connect things to things, the stereotypes. So it's easier for us to see someone who is the feminine as being the way they have Goldman, mm-hmm. and masculine the way they have Narcissus.
Well, maybe then he did too much, because then maybe we're seeing past that. We're seeing past just pushing the maybe implying something else.
Laurie, I think you had your hand up.
I agree with Theo. I think they're so extreme when they describe them that it seems almost like they're like different parts of ourselves, like they're portraying just the different, you know.
You get this gold cigar in this one, Laurie. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things we're talking about is we're looking at the story too superficially. We're looking at it as an adventure story. It's not an adventure story. The story is an inner journey. The story is a metaphor. story is a metaphor for us in our lives as individuals, not as people going out in the world. So what Hess has done is he has used, he's polarized these people, not so that we can more blatantly see the symbol or that he can create his characters. He's not interested in characters. He's interested in ideas that coexist within us and how they are separate us and how they can possibly be integrated and how they are manifest in our lives. So yeah, he goes about this as an allegory more than he goes about this in any other way. What he's trying to do is prove a point. Hermann Hesse was a PK. He was a devout mystical Christian. He had discovered Jungian psychology, and this, all those sort of issues and that sort of dream reality state are what he's playing with here. What he's done is he sort of divided this down the middle to kind of show us more clearly how that works. The thing that makes this book a powerful one, generally speaking, is that what it does is it talks about those sides of ourselves that are getting along together, allowing each other to sort of coexist in their own worlds. In fact, I want to talk about their relationship, because their relationship is a metaphor for a relationship with ourselves. And so I think I would like to really sort of talk about that first section of the book that bored some of you, the first 60 pages when they're setting up the whole thing, setting us up before we start traveling. And there are a couple kind of parts of it that I think are really important. One thing I want to address before I go into that a bit is that idea of the masculine and feminine. Christine, you brought that up of like, are all men thinkers and are all women artists? And I think, as so many of you have already stated, the issue not is not what your sex is so much as how the world is viewed. Now, where do you think our stereotypes came from? Where do you think, say, 10 years ago, that sort of issue of women being more the feminine, more the sort of intuitive, more the feeling person, and men being the ones who went out in the world, where do you suppose that evolved from? That evolved from this other thing that we now look at as being sexist. That is to say that a long time ago, in a world far away or something like that, the whole idea of masculinity and femininity was not the thing that came from our sex so much as our sex was a manifestation of that. We're looking at it from the wrong perspective. We're looking at it from the wrong part of the telescope. What happened is, from my understanding of it, is that there were these realizations that there were different types of energy that were manifest in the world, not manifest as individuals, not manifest as isolated parts, but as things that are kind of shuffled together like a deck of cards, not mixed together as and dissolved into each other as salt and water might be, but shuffled together that you can sort of see them as participating in separate little chunks. And those parts being that the reality that we all have feminine and masculine parts in us, and those parts can be seen as just styles. You can call them left brain, right brain if you want to, which is something that Kate and I have a problem with from time to time, more Kate than me. Or you can call them anything you want to call them. But feminine, masculine makes sense to us because we recognize it. I think it's very interesting that we're so sensitive to that. You know, the women's movement and realizing what our culture has done, not just to women, but what it's done to our feminine sides and what it's still doing to our feminine sides. I mean, most of the people I talk about who are in women's liberation, as I said earlier, sometime over the last couple weeks, are just getting into three-piece suits and running out there and being men. I mean, what is that all about? And I think this, we need to look at that issue from a more internal way. I'm not going to kind of keep rehashing this whole thing again. Kate, do you have anything to add while I'm looking for my great quotes here?
No, I'll hit you later.
What do Narcissus and Goldman have in common? Let's talk about what their commonalities are. Tom, you said that there were a couple of them you knew about.
Well, they're both so driven by faith. They both bear this recognizable mark that not only they themselves kind of can see, but everyone can see something different about them. So I think I read another book by Hesse called Damien, and he bore the mark of Cain, which is the same thing. He's really big on that fate and destiny type of thing where this per, you know, this, there's only one thing that this person can do, and ultimately that will have a, an exceptionality.
Okay. Let's see if we can explore that one point with the mark of fate. What does that mean? Anyone want to talk about what that means?
Inevitability.
Inevitability. Okay. What else? It's a good word. Anyone else want to throw in another word? A sense of mission might be another way of looking at it. The mark, calling it the mark of fate and inevitability has a kind of lack of personal power about it, which in a way Hess talks about, because in a way Hess feels that that's what we all experience in our lives. But for me, having a sense of mission implies a certain degree of choice, which in fact these characters have, and that we are constantly confronted with choice in the first part of the book anyway. After that, it's sort of, the coaster is rolling and there's not much you can do about it.
Seems like the choice, though, is coming from that. I see Goldman's choice is almost like, I feel he's looking almost more of what his Narcissus said about his mother, to an extent that he thinks that that's so true, that he's just like following it more than following himself even. I see that sometimes, and that's what I get out of what Tom said, is following kind of fate, that he kind of realizes, oh, I'm following my example of my mother instead of my father, and he's almost, it seems like he's doing it in a replica without adding his own touches to me.
Mm-hmm. Just getting what Laurie said earlier about, you know, that they're just part of the same person, Narcissus and Goldman, and even his mother. If you think of it as, well, yeah, he's following his mother, but his mother's really part of himself. And yeah, Goldman, I mean, Narcissus told him what he should do, or, you know, what he shouldn't do, but Goldman's just a part of him telling him that. So maybe that's where you get that sense of mission, as opposed to inevitability.
What else do they have in common, then? The sense of mission, the mark of fate, inevitability. What else do they have in common?
Their faith.
Pardon me?
Their faith.
Okay, they have a deep, abiding sense of faith. They have a real personal, spiritual thing inside them that, although may be different in its style, is not so different in its content.
Hey, I kind of thought it was kind of weird how, not really weird, but how Goldman does have this strong faith and he really believes in God. And yet, he was committing adultery when he changed, but he still had God with him. Like when he went into the house and he was that little boy, that little lady, and, you know, and Fester and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's a very interesting message, too, what it's saying, is that, I've already been accused of saying I'm going to get back to that later, and I don't, and so I'm going to jump ahead and sort of bite the bullet, as they say. What is this issue there? That here we have two people manifesting their spirituality, devout believers who are choosing these very different ways of life, very different ways of life that manifest themselves by some of our today standards as being immoral, and yet God seems to be with them anyway. How does that affect you guys? What does that mean to you? Do you dismiss it as just being a book, or does that affect you in other ways?
Important. It's part of what it says to me is that is what we've sort of been talking about that is coming through almost all these books, that there's a God in all of us, and it's not a God of rules, or it's a personal God that you need to find in yourself and others, and that so his God is the same God, and I'm just using God for a term, it can be a lot of different things, but and it's still the same God that everyone has, but he's come to know a different aspect of it. It's kind of the God that's hiding, that is sort of playing hide and seek in everybody, and you have to find where God's hiding in you. And so, no, it's not something that I dismiss as, oh, well, that was then. I mean, it's important to realize that there can be a different God, a different part of the same God in every person.
That must have been sort of disturbing for some of you to sort of see that message.
Yeah, it was kind of scary because I know all these rules, and I say, well, I'm going to follow these rules. And then it comes to a time where, gee, this feels so right, but theoretically it's so wrong. But it feels so right. And so and I go, well, what were the rules for it? Do I just like blow them off now? And so it's kind of scary. I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma. How many of you listened to the nonviolent talk last night? Any of you? Nobody here? Everyone was too busy. It's too bad, because these issues, in fact, were raised, actually, in that talk. And it would have been really neat to hear Tom, who is is very devout in his own sort of belief, talk about what that meant and what that means in terms of dogma and stuff. Hi, did you have something to share?
Kind of what we were talking about, why could he do this adultery and still have faith, kind of is a metaphor for me to see of things that, how we have to shape our own faith, not by other people's rules. There are more rules in the Bible than we can follow, and there are certain ones that are said to be more important than. So we believe that and we follow them, but there's still, if you look at some others in there, to me, it seems like somehow we justify that that's okay, but.
Excuse me.
That we really follow along by what somebody else tells us that rule is saying. And this kind of, I mean, is an extreme case, maybe not for him, but of a way of forming our own faith and having being able to believe our own belief and not what somebody else tells us our belief should be. That's nice.
We talked to Elmer one night, so all these ideas are stolen from Elmer. Elmer told us that Jesus came, or Elmer was telling us his personal faith perspective, whereas, and I think it was something like, good to hear, where Jesus came to abolish all the rules, where, you know, that's how he sees the message of the gospel. The rules have absolutely no bearing. It's, you know, so what if these people are Goldman is such an absolute sinner? He's still a saint, and yet Narcissus, the one who's so very close to God, supposedly, he's also still the sinner that shouldn't be able to reconcile himself with God.
The sense that if there aren't any rules, that you'll follow what's going to be right.
It's
anyway.
Not that we're giving these rules that we have to follow to be Christians, which in one sense goes back to our conversation about Christianity, how some people were kind of upset by it because, you know, certain people were laying down certain rules about being Christians, and it seems that that's not Christian message, supposedly. Elmer used the word implications, where if we call ourselves Christians, we're given these implications of what is right and wrong, or, you know. And that's something that pointed out that Jesus did in all of his parable telling. He gave those parables so that we might be better directed in asking the right questions about our faith. But we were never given the set answers that we needed to follow.
Tom, do you have your hand up?
As I said, when I started this book, I was really upset by that. When he got out and he was running around, and to me, it is still so long. I mean, he doesn't even feel guilty. doesn't even think. I mean, that really bothers me, and I'm still waiting for him to feel guilty. But when he got out, I thought he had almost abolished his faith, and I was really surprised when he started, you know, saying prayers and stuff after he'd run around like this. And I just am still having trouble seeing how he can think he's so faithful and not feel guilty, because to me that is, I mean, he has been really immoral. And I got really hung up on that, and I had to be reminded there was more to the book.
No, that doesn't change throughout the rest of the book. I think what you need to do when you're reading that is taking the metaphorical value of it and see what's happening. This is there's more to the, than meets the eye. I respect your belief. Try and see if you can transcend that just a bit in the context of the book and see if you might be able to find a little more room for yourself in there. Keep trying at it. We'll talk about that more. Go ahead, Tom.
Going along with Todd said, being backed up a second, I agree with what he said, and I know that message comes through, but there are always little kickers in the Bible that kind of set up these paradoxes, because also Christ says that he did not come to abolish a single letter of the law, and that's, I mean, it's kind of, that's what...
Both interpretations are true.
Hmm?
Both interpretations are true, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's, I don't...
Simultaneously.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know how that really can work. Maybe you check, it also talks about him writing the law in our hearts. And maybe... what we got to understand what he's talking about at all. When he says he doesn't come to abolish one letter of the law, I don't think he's talking about the law that was given in the Old Testament about everything from how many steps you can walk on the Sabbath to circumcision on the eighth day, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think, you know, he was talking about God's law, and that's what we need to. What we need to figure out and follow, and that's what's written in our hearts. And maybe that, friend.
Okay. Yeah, I guess, I don't know, I feel like usually in most religions, Christianity, you know, and most of the other religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, they have a kind of common core at their laws in a way, or laws of the heart, and that is to love your neighbor and love God, and kind of just, you know, love your neighbors as yourself. Most people agree with that. And yet, I haven't gotten to the part where he's committed adultery with. But obviously, this whoever he committed adultery with is married. And I don't see how he can love somebody else if he's sleeping with his wife. I'm sorry, I just can't accept that.
It's very upsetting, yeah.
I just don't see any way out of it, I guess. I just, you know, I can't support it in that. Even if I'm not saying he's not Christian, he's not faithful, I'm just saying that I see it as a mistake, as a slip. You didn't consider that as
one.
More than
one
throughout the rest of the book.
Go, Lisa.
All I was going to say is I think that we also, I need to keep reminding myself in this discussion, particularly right now, that we are looking at the we're looking at the surface right now. I mean, we're looking at it as two different characters again, and we're not looking at the real meaning of the book. And I wish you would talk more about that, because I'm getting really agitated right now.
I'm not talking about that very specifically. Although this is translated, which means that the style of the writing is a little more awkward than it might be if we all knew German and could read it in the original. Hermann Hesse was extremely capable in making his metaphor go very deep, meaning that every detail in the book is there for a reason. It's not there just because he sort of automatically put it there or because he was unconsciously inspired. And so the issue of what he's talking about here, especially in terms of the adventuresome, the adultery, the sexuality, the sensuality, and how harmonious that part is for Goldman with his God, is there for a purpose. And so I think to be able to discuss these issues and confront them is even if it's painful, is not a bad idea. And I think that what Brent's talking about is a really significant part of the book. And so I'm not interested in avoiding it particularly. And one of the things that yesterday when we had the discussion about Dr. Martin Luther King here, I was expressing a point of view that I had, and I ended up my point of view saying that I just didn't see how there could be any other way. Elmer sort of turned his cannon at me and zeroed in with me in the hairline and said that it is never true that there is never another way. That whenever you're at that point where you can't see another way, what you need to do is to laterally, he didn't say this, but this is my interpretation, you need to step outside of yourself to look at the picture that you are so focused on your own narrower perspective that you can't see other options. There are always options. I flushed red, I got nervous, I felt like a jerk, and I kind of sat there for a little while as I could feel steam kind of rising up the back of my shirt. And now I realize in a way, Brent, that you've done the same thing that I did. And I recognize it, and I understand what that's about. What we need to do then is rather than impose our own belief without losing it, I mean, I think that's the important part of it, is we need to honor ourselves, is let's look and see what this meant to Goldman. Let's not dismiss him as being an immoral sinner yet. Let's wait and see what this is about to him. And I think this might be something worthy of pursuing, since he does this repeatedly throughout the book. And in fact, to him, this is more of a kind of worship, if you will. And it doesn't stop him from having trouble with it later on. But I think it is something that it's about. So what does some of the rest of you think about this very issue? Do you all feel pretty much like what Brent feels? Are there any of you that feel differently about it? Dad?
My thing comes from personal experience of being a pretty good sinner. And also, yeah, the conversation with Elmer and the whole idea of acceptance. And like I say, my God, at the same time that we're such a beautiful saint when we're praying in church, also the worst sinner. What right do we have to come before God and say, cleanse me, O God? And then at the same time when we're in the midst of heated passion with somebody else's wife, we're still a saint in God's eyes, if that's what so choose to believe.
Go ahead, yeah.
Are there sins that are worse than other sins?
Sin is sin.
I know. Does it really matter if you, if you adultery or... Yeah, I almost say it to one of the lesser sins. I mean, it's so hard to think of it as a
hierarchy of sindom. Interesting thought.
I think a sin is a sin, but I will also admit that there's some sins that I personally say to myself are worse than others. But yet I still believe a sin is a sin.
Simultaneously.
Yes, it contradicts. It's because maybe I can't let go and let it be. But I see that adultery and I see murder a little in a different light than I do lying sometimes. In some line, okay, there's some. But I know I need to be able to focus and see them all as a sin as a sin. But think of all the people involved that really might get hurt when adultery happens. And maybe they don't think of it at the time, you know.
Okay, I was going to answer in that. I have trouble with that, too. I say, yeah, sin's a sin, and then I go, well, but me, that's some are worse than others. But what I think is that when you sin, if you feel bad about it, you have to do something about it. And if it's lying, it's not too hard to correct that. But where if it's adultery, it is more. And so in that sense, it makes up for them being equal because you have to do more to, I don't know, even the score or whatever.
Let's keep going like I call it. Yeah. Unless it's an emergency, Tom and Kai have their hands up first.
I just maybe this will be helpful, maybe not, but what a friend told me once, what sin meant. Sin from the Greek is like an archery term, and it means missing the target. And so if you have a kind of a target up here, well, if you miss the target, doesn't matter how far you miss it by. I think that's what
why the word sin was used.
Sounds like almost as Bible. Like, like, didn't miss the target at all.
Well, I think that the analogy that you have there is a real powerful one, is that if you miss the target, doesn't matter how far, but also it's saying is that what is it that you're shooting for? Is the sin then the act of missing your goal, or is the idea of the sin missing somebody else's target? That's sort of an issue to consider. Kai?
I'm just interested in somehow how these paradoxes are coming up. It's like first we, you know, we try to rationalize things, but then we look at how we see things and realize we do believe two ways, and in some ways, in other ways, we don't let ourselves because our rational mind doesn't let us do it. But in some ways, it's okay. In one way, the thing Tom was saying about it says it one way in the Bible and says it the other way, and you can't understand it. It's because it's a paradox. It's full of paradoxes. And maybe if we rationalize that some of these things are paradoxes, that we can think of things more than one way, that helps us understand it.
Part of what I'm thinking from what I'm hearing from people is back to my new idea about the God in every one of us, and there's a different part. And for Goldman, I really don't think he feels like he's hurting anyone. And I haven't seen where he has. Okay? I mean he doesn't feel like the husbands are going to be hurt, and the women don't feel like the husbands are going to be hurt, and the women aren't hurt. He feels that he is giving more joy than hurt. He's not, and in that sense I see it as not sinning. Because he's not hurting. And also for him, I mean, our missing the target way off, like not even getting to the board, you know, could be adultery. But for him, man, that might just be a hair's breadth. It might hit the target for him. It might not be a sin for him. Because that could be the part of God. I mean, God gave it to us.
Theo, David, Tom.
Well, I'm going to take this in the wrong light, kind of warping the idea, but back to Meg's idea of that a lie is easier to make right than adultery, that's almost saying that, oh, I did this bad and there's things that I have to do to be right with God. I have to, what's the word I'm looking for?
Repentance.
Yeah, but, oh, I have to do this thing to the adultery, you have to do so much more. And I don't know if that's the message of Christianity.
Okay, let's hold on to that one. David, you were next.
Go with what you said. If I remember right in the book, he talked about how the wives thought that they were going to be beaten when they got back. In fact, it happened to the first lady that he committed adultery with, but she thought that she better get back because she's going to be beaten. But in a way, it's like it was worth being beaten for.
Yeah, so why is it hurting her? She made the decision. I mean, she knew.
Yeah, but I mean, you think he Goldman would think, well, you know, if I do this to her, she's going to get beaten, so why should I? Is it worth going like?
Well, how do you know she's going to be beaten for adultery? It could have been beaten.
Wait, I think we're getting slightly off track here. Go ahead, Tom.
Even more than that, letting alone the wife's human being with Lydia and her father, the knight. Her father, you could tell in that walk, you know, that he was hurt. I mean, he was hurt deeply that this guy that he accepted into his house and befriended, and that all this went out, that, you know, he was really hurt by that. And I think Lydia probably will end up being hurt by it, because chances are she'll be in a convent soon. And
I think that there are a couple of issues here that are real important, and they're issues that are extremely important moral issues in the Judeo-Christian background. And one of them is taking care the whole issue of taking care, David raised it, we've all kind of flirted with it, is that Goldman should realize that his actions are going to hurt somebody and therefore he shouldn't do them. When he finds willing participants with really out having to do very much, then say, hey, I'm ready if anyone else is. And I think that what we deny in this particular case is that everyone makes their own personal choices. And those personal choices are theirs. If those risks mean that they have to suffer something, whether they want to suffer it or not, it's their choice. And the neat thing I think about Goldman in that sense is that he never forces anyone to do anything that they don't want to do. That's the first point. Second one, in terms of how we're all getting really focused on this issue of adultery and sexuality, especially as it relates to sin, is that if you kind of look back at what some of the other hierarchy of sins are, that here we are getting all upset about how much pain we can hurt somebody if we commit adultery, yet we forget the fact that we make these nuclear weapons that are about to obliterate the world. Where is the sin in that? How does that sin relate to these smaller sins? How can these sins that we respond to in an individual level that affect nobody but individuals who make personal choices, how does that relate to the greater sin of allowing something else to be happening that can destroy people who have had no power or no association or no relationship with it at all? How does that respond to our Christian morality? I mean, those are issues, too, that we need to kind of think about. When you think about adultery and we think about what God may be thinking and what that may mean about getting to heaven or not getting to heaven, I think it has to be put in context. So if we react this way to this kind of sin, what is that saying to us? Is this a metaphor to us as well? Is this something else that's going on? I mean, I think it's real important to kind of ask yourself that question. One of the things we talked about last night is being frustrated with people who call themselves very spiritual people who will be extremely upset about the idea of adultery, but who will pay their taxes and support their government and all the rest of those things that what Tom was saying, from a real Christian's point of view, you in fact are a revolutionary, that you are nonviolent, that you don't participate in those issues. And how it's interesting that these things are the ones that we get really upset about. These are the ones that affect us personally. These are the ones that make us want to stamp and weep and pray. But the other ones somehow fade away.
Wait, just a second. I mean, you're attacking you.
Yeah.
I mean, you're saying that if you don't go out and find nuclear war and you don't do this, and this, then
nope. I am not saying that at all. Mm-mm. I'm okay. Asking you to look at how you react to these things as sins and what that means in terms of faith, because faith is one of the things that you base your morality on. And what I'm saying is this is a challenge to that. And I'm just saying, you look at that. I'm not saying you should do anything. I'm asking you to question that. I'm pointing out to you what I consider to be an anomaly in that. That's all.
That is the larger sin of forcing somebody to die or their culture to be destroyed without their choice, he says, is a larger, less personal, but still personal.
I'm pointing out that we don't react to one, you react so intensely to the other. What does that mean?
Who says we don't react?
Pardon me?
Who says we don't react to the other?
I don't know. I haven't heard very much reaction. Here we got a big talk on nonviolence, and I didn't see anyone interested, so I don't know. I'm posing the question.
Can I speak?
Sure.
Thank you. First of all, I've become more thinking more about nuclear war and peace and all that since I've been here. I mean, before it was something, yeah, it's there, yeah, I don't like it, and I push it out of my mind. And it's kind of like, and then I just try to, I guess, forget about it and think about maybe the other sins that are bigger. I mean, shoot, when that big nuclear war movie came out 2 years ago, I avoided it. I wouldn't watch it, it wasn't accepting. The whole point I'm trying to make, though, is that maybe, I don't know, maybe you guys think about nuclear war all the time, it's a part of your everyday life, but I tend to think that maybe the reason that I look at adultery bigger than this part of killing, but when it's becoming more and more aware of it, I'm starting to bend a little, is that this nuclear war stuff is not so close to home, but this adultery stuff, and this stuff that we might be a question with, or getting a situation, is. It's right there. And we feel like maybe we can do something about it more. We can say no if the heat of passion doesn't grab you. And if you got your head on straight. More as than standing up and being able to really stop that weapon or whatever.
Okay.
How do you say that the nuclear war thing isn't close to home?
I mean, because going to PLU, you're living in a ground zero anyway, with McCord and all the other things going on there, Boeing, and then the Trident submarine, and then everything there. I mean, that's pretty close to home, I think.
But it's close, but it's, I don't know how to explain it. It's different.
You're not aware of it.
Right, you got to remember, I pushed it on my mind. I avoided it. I just said, the heck with it. Yeah, I don't like military. I do not. I have this weird thing.
Maybe it's so close to home that you don't
want. I still think this adultery stuff, not that I'm involved in it right now, but it's more close.
That's it.
Yeah, it's personal. It's there.
What? Go ahead and answer.
Well, maybe, I was just going to say, it's a part of our everyday life. But, okay, nuclear war is a part of our everyday life. Oh, I'm spitting it. But, I mean, I don't know. Go for it.
I see what Laura's saying is that, okay, it's great you're concerned about these personal things. They are important. But with your faith, what does your faith have to do with being responsible in a community in the world, too? And you know, just how can you compare them and why? Why do you push it out of your mind? That's,
yeah. Well, no, I'm not. See what I'm saying? I'm starting to become more aware of it. I mean, since I've been here, but I don't know why I pushed it out before. Maybe I was scared.
Well, let's get back to that in a little bit, too. We only have a few minutes before we break. And Carrie, do you want to say something?
Well, this is getting back to when you said, you brought up the thing about nonviolence. I was sitting up there and I got bits and pieces, and I wanted to know how you wanted to fit this in, that conversation in with this book. When he said, I don't know if I heard it right, but had to do with nonviolence and not being passionate or being violent, and I don't know how.
You mean what I talked about, passion? You mean that one part?
I don't know who I heard, but
I did.
See, that's kind of stuck in my mind. Also, and then when the talker was talking about loving his enemy, but and the person asked him, how can you love that person who's your enemy? And it's just to do with this faith. I don't know how you want it. I just want to know how you're going to bring that conversation in and tie it in with the book.
There are a lot of ways of doing that. That's going to take more than a few minutes we have left to do. But maybe we'll try and pick that up later. But I was baiting you guys when I was comparing adultery to nuclear war for a very specific reason. And I'm not surprised that some of you got really incensed by that whole idea. Because I think what we talk about when we talk about these sorts of ideas is the whole issue of control. And one of the things that Goldman represents is of the sense of not controlling. He doesn't really control himself. He doesn't try to control the lives of others. In fact, his whole probably motto in life would be live and let live. And one of the things that a lot of us are feeling really weird about when we see somebody who lives and let lives, who doesn't seem to practice morality, who doesn't seem to control themselves, who doesn't seem to maybe take responsibility for themselves.
Or who has a part of themselves that is like that.
Or who has a part of themselves who is like that, is we get really down on them. And the thing is that oftentimes those people don't, I know your hand's up there now, we oftentimes don't realize that that person probably isn't creating any pain for anyone who hasn't participated, if there is pain. In fact, the idea of not having pain in your life is a myth that we could spend another hour talking about. But what it is that he surrenders his need to control others. And that's the issue that I sort of drive at, is that I think whatever a person's beliefs are, they're important to them, and they should use them for whatever purposes are necessary. But what Goldman does, and what upsets some people about Goldman, is he doesn't try to control others. Darren, I think you had your hand up.
Yeah, he goes with no goal. He talked about that right before he left. It's just about not having a goal, not just going. That is just a small comment.
Yeah, it's a good comment, too. Tom?
I know, I like Goldman. I mean, I admire him. I think he's a good guy. I disagree completely with what he does in some cases. I disagree with what, you know, adultery that he does, but I like the guy. like a person that does that, I think God, he can disagree with what he does, but still love him a lot better than I can. And since, you know, God is the one to, and I think in just about every religion, God is the one who has the power over judgment, if you believe in a judgment, then I'm not going to worry so much about what he's done, I'm just going to worry about what I do.
That's very beautiful. Go ahead, Mike.
I'm going to answer to Theo about 15 minutes ago, but I didn't mean,
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Oh, I think I probably took it wrong. I said that, who was it?
About
being
yourself right to be right with God, and I was saying that I didn't mean it that way. I do things when I said that for myself because I feel guilty when I lie. Or I would, I mean, I know I'd be just feel awful. I mean, probably get sick if I didn't put hope in it. And that's what I meant by that, not necessarily get sick.
Well, I just want to say one thing real quick, and I appreciate how active the discussion was today.
Okay, I publicly apologize for turning the corner too sharply, but there was a point in that corner. And so I think what I needed to do was to establish it a little more with greater clarity. But since I've already told you what the point was in our conversation, was anyone else upset about that turn of events? Okay. Then rather than get to my point, let's go back to where you were and continue the discussion for a little while.
No, we want to know what your point was.
You want to know, but you guys want to continue talking about the issue of the...
Yeah. We just want to know
what you're talking about. Kind of beyond that. Okay. What I was trying to do when I was talking about the moral dilemma is that I wonder sometimes if our view of morality that we, or the rules that we have to guide us in our view of morality is not really about the specific issue, whether it's adultery or even whether it's nuclear war for that matter. I was trying to take two of them that seem to be at opposite poles to kind of draw some connections, but that it's about the idea of control. And one of the things that Narcissus and Goldman is about is the idea of control and surrender, two kind of opposing points of view. Narcissus is someone who is very much in control, must be in control, ultimately becomes in control of the monastery, is the person who relishes and flourishes to a degree under that system of control. Goldman is a person of surrender, who surrenders to the world, to the feminine aspects, to the sensual pleasures. In the process of doing that, he also creates a lot of good, as well as causing some internal disturbance for some of you. And what I think oftentimes happens with our view of what's right and what's wrong, and why we sometimes react so passionately about right and wrong, is that what it is, metaphorically, is the issue of control, our own personal control. The control that we need to have on ourselves, the control we need to push onto others, the control that we need, which is based on a kind of fear that if we don't control, then maybe something horrible is going to happen. Yeah, Tom?
Well, I think one of the big things that bothers us about morality is we think, well, people that we see that have higher morals than us, that we're jealous of because they're better people. People who have lower morals than us, we're jealous of because they're having more fun. I mean, maybe it's the biggest joke and also the biggest challenge that God has given us by either allowing us or creating us to have slightly different morals as a big challenge to see, you know, loving our brother. Maybe that's, I mean, I'm just guessing and I make no pretense to know, but maybe that's something that God has done to kind of test the ultimate law of love.
I still don't see that. I don't see how you're trying to show a sense of surrender
I wasn't trying to show a sense of surrender. What I was trying to do was talk about what it is that upsets us about this particular moral issue. That oftentimes, maybe because they're more personal or for whatever reason, we can become more upset about something like adultery when, but we don't often even think about what the issue of the two worlds is about. My point was that when Annette said that one is more personal and the other is more distant, that was sort of the issue of control. That was sort of what I was talking about.
Okay.
And how morality often is about that.
Okay.
Which was, like I say, one of the central themes of narcissism in Goldman. The whole discussion started this morning, and I was trying to figure out what similarities narcissism and Goldman had. And to recap, what we decided was that they were both marked by fate. I think that's exactly what the book said, that they both were spiritual, and they both had a deep spiritual core. Are there any other commonalities? Yes, Kate?
Yeah, they loved each other.
Love. Very good point. How did they manifest this love?
Well, I put that up at the end of the, at the beginning.
What was, how did they manifest their love? Yeah. And what else, besides accepting each other with who they were, what else did they do?
How about helping each other in every trouble?
Yeah, right? Challenging each other. And also helping each other become more of who they were. Mm-hmm. Kind.
The quote on 64 seems to be what I think Narcissus does, and what he's doing is he's trying to serve his best place. As my goal is this, always put myself in the place in which I'm best able to serve. Wherever my gift can quality find the best soil, the widest field of action, there is no other goal. That Narcissus' best way to serve in that place was he saw how people, he could see the picture from the outside, and so he could inspire Goldman to see this other point of view that he never bothered looking at. And where Goldman maybe found that his gift was love and thought that he should go around and give joy that way. But this way of trying to serve in the places where there's the best soil.
The thing that I found real interesting about that is Narcissus, a person of great and very different beliefs, can encourage somebody else. In fact, Goldman says that what you're doing is you're encouraging me to go out there and sin. You're encouraging me to be other than what you are. How could you do that? And to paraphrase Narcissus' reaction, he says, Goldman, you're half awake. You're still sleeping in part. That what you need to do is be awakened to yourself. And if you awake to yourself, then you will be doing more good to the world than trying to become somebody other than who you are. I thought that was a real important part. But I'm trying to find the quote, and I can't exactly do that. But it doesn't matter. I think you remember that part fairly well. They're constantly talking in those first 60 pages about their differences over and over and over again, which I, of course, underlined incessantly, and now I can't really quite pull the quote I need, but you all understand that pretty well. Are there any other similarities that they have? Love, faith, yes.
Well, they both stood out. I mean, the first 40 pages of the book, they kept on saying that everybody loved both of them and liked being with them and watching them and felt something different about them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gets back to the mark of faith, but yeah, it's their faith that they did. Okay. Any other similarities that we can find?
Were they both good looking?
Yeah, they both were very attractive in different ways, but yeah.
Where does the way that they stick out in the school as their distinctive character or whatever, what does that have to do with it?
In the same paragraph that talks about their mark, the mark of fate was on them. It was apparent to all, mark of fate. The mark of fate was on them because they seemed to stand out, that there was something about them that seemed, that had that air of inevitability, Kristen said. I can find that quote if you want me to, but it's...
above all the other students, they were sort of like the sun and the moon. Complimenting each other, yeah, that's...
They use the word compliment, in fact. Mm-hmm. Well, you want me to find that quote?
Nah.
All right, we know what their differences are generally. But what I'm interested in is, why is it that people with such great differences still seem to have such abiding affection for each other?
Okay, this is the way I see it, and I guess maybe the way I see it this way is because I can see my mom and dad. My dad's a thinker, my mom's a feeler. It seems like you put the two of them together and they make sense. Does that make sense to you? I mean, I feel like they complement each other so much that, you know, one has all these qualities and another one has all these other qualities, and you combine the two of them together and it's like they make this one. I mean, I can't describe it.
Thank you. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I just wanted to say that this is really similar. Maybe you like in the opposite person, you know, that quote, opposites attract or whatever. But it can mean, I don't mean just lovers, you know, meeting friends, how you click. Maybe you like, let me clarify after I say this. Maybe you like what you can't be. I mean, I'm a certain kind of person, and I need to, well, when I find it, but I need to be that person, okay? Even though I might like these other things, but if they're not really me, but at least if I'm friends or share a love with someone, then I'm able to have that innocence, and I'm able to share it, and I can also learn from it. Mm-hmm. And it's the making of one. It's making you more complete, and it's
synergistic.
What's that word mean?
It means the whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
Synergistic.
It's good word. You know the GRE's are coming.
Kind of along the lines of in that interesting type of, Narcissus can see in Goldman a life that he never can live himself, but it's like his chance to really be a part of that life because Narcissus and him are so close. And Goldman can see in Narcissus the monk that he wanted once to become, but he knew that he couldn't actually be. So they're sort of getting to live this life without actually living it. But they're so close, you know, that it really is kind of a part of them.
Multiple realities.
Is that your hand up there,
Brian? No, I'm speaking.
Laura.
No, it was just what everyone else said, just that I remember what Kate said before is that when you admire someone, it's almost like your mirror image, you're seeing something in them that you really want in yourself.
Okay, so let me see if I can paraphrase this. What we're saying then is that we think that the point, the real abiding, one of the abiding reasons for their affection is the fact that each of them gets to experience part of themselves that they don't have. So it's kind of a completion, I think. What is the, is your hand up?
Yeah, I had an idea.
Can your hand is? Would you like to wave it at us so we can figure out? Good thought.
I hope I didn't lose it, okay, bear with. And I'm not making excuses or apologies, thank you very much. Anyway, and that's for myself. Anyway, that's on tape. Okay. The whole thing's point is, and I hope I can find it. Okay. What did you just say?
Part of themselves that they don't have.
Okay. Maybe you do have it, and maybe you can't really be. I mean, maybe because, here we go, opening up, guys. You have these rules, okay? And you know, gosh, I love God, and I really want to follow these rules because I love God, and I really feel that's what He's telling me to do. But dang it, I really got these other feelings, and I wish I could do something with them. But it's like I have a lot of friends that don't maybe follow the same rules that I do, but dang it, I love them. And maybe there is a part of me that wishes I could be like that. But yet again, because I can't, because my moral side of me and my faith side of me won't let me do it. I can't miss it, but I don't know.
Maybe you can do it.
Yeah, maybe it's not a part of you that you can't be, but a part of you that you aren't yet letting yourself
Well, maybe it's
maybe.
Problem of living a enigma, two-parted
life, that you don't want to live a contradiction, that you can't do it, but if you do it, you're going to have to give up something of what you are.
Why?
You can't be a contradiction.
In conflict.
Yeah.
You're all amazing.
You can.
Stubbornly around those paradoxes, anyway. But I guess what I'm trying to get at, is that basically what we said before is that they are completing the emptiness that they've experienced in themselves. Although in that sort of presaging my point, what is the implication of that? Let's sort of now take it from Narcissus and Goldman and put it in our own lives a little bit. And what is the implication of that, Darren?
I don't know, I just had a thought about that. That it's kind of like, it's not this way with me so much, but I've just seen it in other families where the parent impresses upon the child so much what the parent wants done. I mean, what the parent couldn't have done, and so on and so forth, that the child, kind of like what the father impressed upon Goldman, that you live this life because I didn't live it, and I want to see you live it for me.
Mm-hmm. I can grow up.
One thing I'm kind of thinking about is when we talk about like Narcissus and Goldman, or you know, there's something different about them, and also the Father Daniel, Brother Daniel. It stands out, those three, between all the other people in the monastery and things. And I guess I would get more out of it if I were to figure out like what was the difference between those three and the rest of the other people. Because I guess I don't understand why everybody's saying, oh yeah, I can see myself as Narcissus or Goldman or whatever. What about the other people? They're just kind of nowhere. You know, does that mean that Narcissus and Goldman were kind of given more power or something than the other people? Or was it, I mean, Narcissus really didn't, or Goldman didn't really know himself when he first came there. And then Narcissus all of a sudden just picked him out and decided to open his eyes, but why didn't he do it to any other students that were there?
Because they were the inner self.
I think Hess uses that because they are so much one or the other.
Archetype.
And that by doing that, you can find the blend, which is all these other people. And I mean, there are other people who are that one way or the other, but by using these, you can find everyone else on the scale in between. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it does. So I think this kind of ties in with what she said about them being so different, but yet we were talking about them being really a metaphor for the same person. And Theo talked about living in contradiction. You know, those two parts in probably most of us live in contradiction. We're always having struggles within ourselves between those two. And I think what this class is about is the same thing that this book is about, is that developing that friendship, and that friendship within us, between these two parts, becomes the life force in us.
That has to do with imaging yourself, which ones and what percentages you take and how you combine them.
Kate and I were talking, you were at first asked about completing the emptiness in each other and kind of why that is. And we were talking one night about how our parents kind of lived a dream through us, things that they didn't do, and then we essentially tried to carry it out, felt it was an obligation, and I was wondering why they felt they couldn't do it, you know, why they didn't pick up when they realized it and keep going for it themselves, and why there's such a thing in our culture of denying parts of you. Why is it so fearful that you can't? You're stuck, you know, you have to deny those parts that you're frightened of or don't think you have the potential to do.
Well, silence is great. No, maybe it's, our society is so into like conformity. And when you're a part of these different groups, that you become associated with during your life, the groups want you to be, to conform to them too. And everything's got to be so consistent. And it's like, this is off, but it's got a point, and I'm not making excuses. Look at the dance. Look at the dance like the POU. I mean, I predict, and maybe we'll prove me wrong, and hallelujah if we do, we're not going to go back there and dance like we did over there in the hotel. We're going to go back there, and maybe once in a while we might, get a shot in it. About 8 more steps than we would have before, but then we're back to our little 2 steps. Smiling, you know, and we're conforming back to it again. And I'm not saying it's totally bad, but is it really letting ourselves be ourselves? It seems like it's off a tangent, but for some reason I felt like saying this conformity thing. Because someone was talking about it, and I forgot, but oh well, it was there.
We have to accept also that leaving Holden, we are going back to a place that is totally unlike here. And yes, you are. You have to be realistic. You are going to lose some of the closeness that you have here. Because if you don't admit that to yourself now, that's not being realistic. It's just a matter of how much are you going to let go.
You're also going to leave PLU.
Yeah.
You're
right.
And are we going to be able to then leave PLU and go back and be what our real souls are? Or are we going to go along and conform just like the yuppies conform and then, you know?
It's a matter of being what you are. I mean, realizing who you are.
Yeah.
In a sense, we conform to PLU, but when we came here, we also conform to Holden. We're not superficial anymore. We dance the way that they dance. We eat what they eat. We take notes a different way here. We do there. We conform to Holden too. We like this conformity better, but it's still conformity.
Some of us like this conformity better.
That's
right.
This is true. Sorry.
There's also been some conformity has become such an evil word. I mean, everybody's saying, you know, that conformity is wrong, either it shouldn't. But, you know, some people, if it's comfortable to conform sometimes, or if that's what you feel like you want to do, then it's perfectly all right to conform. You don't have to conform completely, or you don't have to go completely off. You make decisions. If some people that you're with are acting in a way that you like and you want to act that way, then act with them. Don't just not act with them because it's being conformed.
Yeah, I think we have to move away from rights and wrongs. So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think you're right, Tom. Annette, and then Darren.
Mm-hmm. Just a second.
Shall Darren go first? Or should we
wait?
Yeah. No, my window finished, so I didn't say anything.
Okay, Lori.
Something in response to what Tom said. Maybe conformity may be good to an extent because, like what Lori was saying, if you want to go out and make money or whatever, and, you know, follow that. But then you won't feel satisfied and you'll lose yourself and you'll find that there's something missing that you've got to follow what's inside of you or what is real.
Actually, Laurie said that the Hindu said that.
We're Hindu.
Can I just wait a minute? Because Annette's going to lose it if we don't get her to say it.
Yeah, I got to go to my room. Just kidding. Okay. I agree. To go ahead. Okay, but I agree in a sense with what Tom says. But I just want to, I guess, reiterate if that's the right word. Are we okay? June said that. Okay, yeah, I was saying we're conforming when we're back at PLU, but yeah, we conform when we came here, and that's true. Well then, are we conforming everywhere? Maybe people don't want to admit it or whatever, and I'm not saying this is the word, you know, but maybe we are, and maybe through a great time of life, we have done that. You know, our parents have taught us, okay, you're gonna do this, and this is the way, you know, our family believes, and we went right along with it, a lot of us. I mean, maybe some of us didn't, I don't know, but you see them getting that? I mean, yeah, I see. If you decide that, yeah, you really do want to conform to the group because this is what you want, But I wonder if maybe there's some vibe you get from the group that makes you decide if you really want to do that, but deep down you really don't. It's bizarre, but there's something under there.
If you're conforming by not conforming.
Yeah, the sort of double negative routine can kind of keep going around about that. But I think one of the things you're talking about is the sense that we need to belong. And belongingness is a very powerful kind of thing in terms of conformity. Kai.
Where it hits me, I think that what almost sometimes we feel like we're sitting here and we're going, okay, be yourself so much that you never conform, and then you know you can't do that. And maybe this will make you understand me better. Growing up in my family, it was real different. My parents didn't really ever have a dream for me. They kind of always made me make the choice. Another thing, both of them, it was almost like conforming was a bad thing. For my dad, he's such an individual that we got the sense in our family that it was good to be different all the time. That's how I see my dad. And of course, a lot of it is rubbed off on me, and I like it. But I have to take it where he thinks, okay, it's great to be different all the time. It's okay if you accept yourself and you... But he never relates all his great ideas with other people sometimes because he's so into himself. And where I try to see it was what Tom's saying, that it's okay to conform. It's okay to conform so you can share those things where if you are completely yourself, you lose that. And that's where...
What I was trying to say is we can all be nonconformists, but we have to recognize that somebody else may be nonconforming in the same way that we're nonconforming. I mean, if you're in a place and most of the people are cold around you, that they don't like to any kind of touching or anything like that, and then there's a small group of five or six people that go around hugging each other, well then they're nonconformist in the eyes of the whole big group, but really they're conforming to each other. So you have to recognize that there's going to be other people that have similar traits or similar likes as you, and you can conform with them in some areas, not conform with them in others, conform with some people in others, and you know, there's a big mixture in there. It's not a question of totally conforming or totally not conforming.
It's selective.
Christine, you have your hand up?
Oh, no.
Yeah, when I think of nonconformity, I guess I think of the word individualism. And just a while ago, we were talking about Black Elk, we were kind of putting that down. We were thinking Black Elk is a community, and we're, you know, uplifting a community type of thing. And now it seems like, I don't know how we're doing it, but it sounds kind of like we're reversing almost. Say now we're uplifting the individual. And so it's a paradox maybe.
Well, I think that one of the things that's real important about any social situation you're in is whether or not it is your situation. If it's your situation, as Tom says, conforming or not, it's yours, and you find yourself in it, and it doesn't matter how it appears. That's a real rich bit of material. And there is the illusion in America of individuality, sort of the person, and we all reap the bitter fruits of that as well, which have to do with lack of being able to communicate intimately with people, have to do with feeling very alienated and having a culture that increases your alienation in very subtle but obvious steps, and sometimes obvious steps. And we're not uncomfortable with that as well. And so we all have a longingness to be with people and a lack of ability to be able to do it. I mean, all that, those are the bitter fruits of it. On the other hand, having a community that's real tight and real conforming, as many of us came from whether Northern or Southern European backgrounds that had that, they were very stifling and didn't give anyone a lot of, like our parents or grandparents came from environments that were so stifling in some ways that maybe they didn't give them room to be who they were, and they ran away from them and came to this country. So that there's, you're right, that there is a paradox there. That's a real powerful one. I'm glad you brought that out.
I think it would be important for you to describe briefly an analogy.
Remember when we talked about the first class, we talked about metaphor and analogy and what the differences were? Any of you remember
differences between the two?
Go ahead, Laurie.
A metaphor is like a picture or like a story that describes something, almost like a mirror. An analogy is more like its opposite.
Or people.
No. People, this is like this.
Yeah, an analogy is more like two parallel things where I'm telling you a story that is more or less equal to this other thing. Where a metaphor is some little small piece that is part of a larger whole, and in order to grab that larger whole, we'll look at the little piece of it to see it. So one is like this, and the other is sort of like that, if you can follow me so far. Why did I need to do that? I forgot. Oh, the book as a, you have to refresh my memory, Kate. Why did I do that?
As an analog for implications and relations. I'm just trying to pull it back into that.
Okay. We'll get back to that point somewhere along the line. I wanted to get back to my original thing that started this whole thing about conformity, which was the implications of needing to fill yourself up through your needing to fill the empty place in you through your relationship with somebody else, and what the implications of that are. Originally, we started saying that one of the things that made Narcissus and Goldman's relationship so powerful is that each of them were such opposites that they kind of needed each other. Narcissus needed to experience vicariously the part of life that Goldman experienced, and vice versa, as a way of making them whole, I think, was what Christine had said.
It's like back to projection that you were talking about. Before, we've been talking about projecting things about ourselves that we don't like onto other people and doing that. Well, this is kind of the same thing, but we're more projecting things that we do like or things that we want, but it's also a kind of that projection thing.
And what are the implications of that? What are the implications in our own lives if we do that in relationships?
It's like it can depend on other people too much.
And when you depend on other people too much, you're not depending on yourself. Now that, which does not mean, once again, we get that issue of selfishness and alienation, but I think there's a thing, and a phrase in modern pop psychology called codependency. And what codependency is about is, in a way, what Narcissus and Goldman aren't. And this is sort of why it's important. I wanted to kind of just get into that myth about filling each other up. Codependency is that thing when you sort of say to yourself, well, I'm not a whole person. I'm not complete in myself. So I'm going to find somebody who's going to complete me. What happens then is you find someone who completes you, and you live your life in part for that other person. That seems fine. That's part of what we all expect from romantic relationships. What happens then if something happens to that relationship? If that person should die, or if that person should run off with somebody else, where does that leave the individual who has lived much of their life for that other person? It leaves that individual atrophied and empty. The issue, I think, with Narcissus and Goldman that's really important is neither of them are atrophied or empty. What they do is they recognize and value what the other person is, but they are still whole people in themselves. No. Goldman can run off and do what he does and would never, ever want to live the life of Narcissus, loves him and respects him for what he is, and Narcissus, conversely, chooses his life because that's exactly the way he sees it, experiences, understands that he gets something and learns something from Goldman's existence, but doesn't need Goldman in that sense. Their attraction is love and not dependency. Love and not need. It's an important part of their relationship. Christine?
I just was going to say that I think is one of the key points of the book, because they both keep their individuality. I mean, they both have their self-images there. And I just think that is one of the key things in a relationship, is when you can keep that, you know, be dependent on yourself, but allow, you know, the other person to know that you need them at the same time. That's just key. I'm really glad you brought
it. You're saying that you're not giving up that part of yourself.
You're not giving up. I'm saying you can stand on your own two feet, yet the other person at the same time knows that, you know, in Narcissus and Goldman terms, I think both of them could stand on their own two feet, yet the other person knew how the other person felt, knew how important the other person was to him, but they weren't dependent in any way. and kind of
love and intimacy without dependency.
Right.
And I think that's a real important model that Hess was getting at, which is one that's real difficult for us to see, and especially in the context of the only model we have for relationships with people is a romantic one. Even if it's a friendship, there still is the romantic image, and the romantic image is based on codependency, mutual dependency. And we value that. In fact, a lot of times we think that that's really what it's about. We look for a mate. We want to be filled up by them. We want to be completed by them. And I think those things are real powerful, and they feel good at first, but they don't feel good always. And sometimes they stop feeling good fairly quickly. And one of the things about that that's real important is when someone says independence, I can almost feel the little button being pushed. Oh, removed, inaccessible, cold, someone who doesn't participate. Basically, we think of independence as being the opposite of intimacy, of being intimate. And that's part of the important message to me that they're talking about here, is that it is quite possible to be intimate and to be able to surrender yourself to the acceptance of another person and to commingle lives without needing that person to prop you up. You can still be standing.
That is the women's issue of the 80s, but also
would you like to elaborate, Kate?
Yeah, heavy duty stuff, right there. Living example. Woo. I don't know how Paul feels about it.
Paul thinks it's funny.
No.
I've struggled with it all my life.
Hi, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the word. What was that word that they did?
Codependency?
No.
Independence,
completing each other, or not completing each other, but complementing each other.
Synergistic.
Just that's so neat. That seems to be, you know, the biggest metaphor for relationships, that just if you can just accept the differences, and you can like their things that are different from you, but learn from their compliments, and that's what all the relationships are. And every time, you know, we deal with each other, that if we can use that and learn from it, that's a skill that's priceless.
Meg?
I want Kate to elaborate more because I'm awesome.
Okay,
I was raised to believe that being myself and being independent and doing my thing was very important. At the same time, I was raised to believe that being a woman, getting married, doing the things that a woman does, have children, stay home and care for others is very important, in expense of my own needs. So there was a very strong dichotomy. I really wanted intimacy, and I felt that if I had intimacy that it would totally cut off my independence. I really wanted independence, but I felt that if I were independent, it would cut off my intimacy. Real struggle in me, and in talking to other women and in all my relationships and in the way I look at people, it affects me very powerfully. So if you get committed to a person, are you gaining something or are you losing something? And the minute you get in a relationship, do you click into a role, and does that role cut out part of you? That's real scary stuff, real powerful stuff. And are you real with that other person? And if you're not real, what happens to the relationship? Because the minute you're not real, then something happens.
Or to put it another way, are you in fact parenting that other person? Remember, we've talked about how our parents live out their dreams through us as children. Are you in fact living out your dreams through your mate, your companion, your husband or wife, or whatever?
And if you have children, what does that tell the children about their own empowerment and what a woman should be or what a man should be, or how to be intimate, how to be independent? This is the way Kai's telling us. He's coming from the opposite end of the spectrum of some of us. Nonconformity is the way it's supposed to be. And it's real important messages there about me.
Well, I came from a terribly religious family.
A what?
A terribly religious.
A what?
Religious.
Terribly
religious family, and where nonconformity was also of high value, where our family life, our Christian values, our presence in the school, what we could do and what we couldn't do in the community, were all marks of our Christian faith. And in a sense, nonconformity was a Christian virtue in that sense, which can also be a conflict, as I sense some of you wrestling with Christianity in relationship to the world. You're not realizing it. Maybe you're not accepting the fact that, especially maybe at PLU and a group of, and find solid groups of like-minded Christians, that you're at the same time setting yourself up for nonconformity in the world in a real strong way. Does that make sense?
Perfect sense.
Okay.
Tom.
It's like talked about Jesus. Jesus was one of the biggest radicals there have been, and yet he was intimate with so many people, and he was so accepting of people. I mean, Jesus accepted the adulteress. You know, Jesus accepted the tax collector. It's something that so many Christians now have forgotten.
Catherine, did you have your hand up?
I had difficulty with it, so lost in the dust.
If you should have to uncover it.
Well, I remember it past it about when you're talking about relationships and codependency. I was thinking also a point was what you expect of the other person that you never tell them.
Amen.
You have
these
expectations, but
yeah, very, very good point. I'm glad you uncovered that one.
Unspoken assumptions as well as expectations.
Yeah. Yes,
I want to ask Kate something, I guess. Okay, I'm not a woman, I guess, so I don't have all these.
We all have our feminine and masculine sides here. I'm going to consider what you ask.
We'll call and find out about it. Anyway, so I guess I don't. Because of the way we're raised and things, you know, it's obviously different. You know, I was taught to play with trucks and everything, not dolls and stuff.
So, I played with trucks too.
Okay. And when I guess my question to you is, I'm curious because say you're struggling with not being dependent on another person. And sometimes I talk to some girls, you know, I've had girlfriends in the past or even just friends that are girls. And they say they've struggled with that and they've come through it and they believe that they still want to be dependent on somebody. And
there
I guess, does that
so
mean that
different.
They're wrong? Or does that mean that they've chosen dependency after all the thinking and hashing around?
There's a difference between different kinds of dependency. There are different terms. And so I myself am involved in a relationship, and I myself make a lot of compromises in terms of what I do and how I spend my time. But this time around, it's not a negative, oh, what I'm losing kind of feeling, because I've had to confront myself inside, and I've had to integrate independence and intimacy. So now I'm working in the balance, and it's going very well, and I'm getting a lot out of it, and I feel that there are some ways that you can interact with people and give up some of what you need to do because that person needs to do other things. But it's much more balanced and it's much more positive for me this time around. I'm not trying to be the wife. I'm not always in charge of the wash. I'm not doing what society in my day told me I should have had to do, but I had to leave all of that behind. A lot of the rules. Gloria, I think you feel something too.
Yeah, and I guess I respond to him by an interdependency. And it's not one-sided on either side, but rather if you are a close couple, there's an interdependency that is very positive.
Cooperation?
Yeah, you'd like to know that you can depend. I mean, that's a responsible
and it's
behavior.
Got positive trust rather than
right,
negative.
Exactly.
Oh God, I can predict it. That I'm going to have to do all this for this
guy. Yeah.
God help me. He never does anything. You know, it's not that now. So it really depends on your attitude and it depends on your relationship. If it's mature and if both of you are content within yourself and happy in yourself, you're doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah,
and if you're not, then you're not.
There's no right and wrong about it. I think it's a real personal thing. To give you a little extra position, Susan has a master's in business administration, saw herself as a typical contemporary career woman who was going to go out there and sort of make her bundle. At a certain point, she started struggling with the reality that she really loved cooking and loved gardening. And what kind of a place is that for a woman of the 70s? I mean, it was a real problem with her to be able to adjust to that, because she felt part of her was conforming to somebody else's norm, getting back to those other things. But she's able to do that from a very independent position, in the sense that she's not being asked to do it by a husband. She's not being required to do it by a family or by a culture. She's making her own personal decision about it. In which case, it may seem dependent because I make most of the money, but it's not a dependency. It's more of a cooperation, or, as Laurie said, an interdependence.
Yeah, I think what's unfortunate is when a woman, or a man for that matter, puts themselves in a position, as Laurie said, and denies that part of themselves and gives themselves up to everybody, their kids, their family, their church, whatever, and then 5 or 10 years down the line, this nuclear holocaust happens to them because somebody leaves them. And I see them, they come back to school and they really are searching for something else to do with their lives. Their kids are gone and they have nothing inside. And they're no longer beautiful. They're no longer good looking. And it's real scary for them to say, but I did everything right, damn it. What happened?
Christine and then Annette.
Okay, I think that, like, I'm not sure who's right now, but, I think you were saying it about Susan, like, in the way that we don't want to be negatively dependent on someone in a relationship, we don't want to be dependent on, like, this movement for women to have to be out there and not like gardening, and we have to be able to be dependent and, I mean, independent and make our own choices for what we really like to do and what we want. And I think that that's kind of a hard thing too, feeling like you have to go with the flow and not want to be the housewife that washes clothes and has a lot of babies, you know, even if that's what you want to do.
But what happens if you don't do that?
If you don't be independent and choose what you want to do, I think that you're probably going to be unhappy. Because like he was saying, Susan felt like she was doing something wrong because she wanted these things, and yet it wasn't what all this female movement for independence was, you know, in the society. So I think she was unhappy because she felt like she was supposed to be, you know, she was supposed to want those things. And I think we have to be able to decide for ourselves what we want, you know, instead of letting other people on that, you know.
It's kind of gone by, but I'll say it because I've been waiting. But I guess I think of it that, I mean, I like being dependent in a sense. I know maybe in a sense I'm too dependent on some people, but I enjoy in the relationship I'm involved in right now, the dependency. But I think what it needs to be is, yeah, it's okay to be dependent in an extent, but not for your own identity. Because then if that, like they said before, that coexistent thingy, or I forgot the word,
codependency.
Thank you. But then the person's gone, and it's like your identity's gone. And that's worse than even just the heartbreak of it, you know? So I think it's I don't know, maybe I'm rationalizing, but I think it's okay to have the dependency, as long as it's not so much as that you're dependent on that person for your own identity. You need to find your own identity.
So interdependency rather than co is what you're really...
What's your definition of inter? I know it's what we've been talking about.
Depending on each other.
Depending on each other. Where's co?
Where cooperation. Co is needing the other person. But
using the other, having the other person fill you up. Or serving the other person rather than yourself.
Yeah, I guess it's inter.
Instead, yeah.
But also, we gotta watch extremes too, because we can't become too dependent on ourselves.
because a lot of times we're the first person to abandon ourselves. Just, I mean, it's true, just like that's what happened with Goldman. When he abandoned himself. His mother was a part of himself. He abandoned that part, and it was Narcissus who had to help bring him around. And we have to realize, maybe this is something like a Jungian philosophy, you know, that we're kind of all a part of each other, and some people know us well enough that we can depend on them a little bit. Sometimes even, you know, we have to listen to them and almost depend on them a little bit more than we depend on ourselves. I mean, I'm not saying, if I was to cut it into percentages, I'm sure it's different with different people, but I mean, you know, maybe you have to depend on yourself 90%, but you still have to recognize that 10% dependence on another person.
Well, and also to be selfishness too. Can't be so dependent on yourself that you become selfish to other people's needs and wants. And
selfishness, that's a word. Gloria, I think, had something to say.
Well, I just wanted to piggyback on what Kate was talking about a few minutes ago about the need to be independent. Mm-hmm. I have a daughter in medical school, and she has come to the reality that the choices she made to go to medical school, she sacrificed in a lot of social and intimacy and all of that because of where she is in her life in medical school. And she sees it different for the guys.
That's right.
The girlfriends are willing to wait and sacrifice anything.
Right. That's right. You've
but not the guys. Mm-hmm. While she's in medical school, no way.
She doesn't have a wife.
So be prepared for that, girl.
Yeah, she ain't got no wife to pick up.
I'm interested in the fact that none of the guys responded to this.
Me too.
The points that Kate and Laurie took care of, those kinds of issues.
Are you guys going through the same
Well,
spot?
I was, I'm almost to the point where last...
Spit it out,
okay.
Whatever.
Last night, yesterday when they were talking about the Martin Luther talk and about blacks, I think Tim was the one who said that when he's in a group of women or in a group of blacks, he tries and puts himself lower because the person that his persona or the white male has downtrodden, or I don't know what you mean.
Through the years,
that it's kind of like now.
Put down.
Now it's Yeah, but I'm trying to get past it. I'm trying to think what's the rest of it. And so I feel like I'm almost guilty of that also then. And because I'm
sort of putting yourself in a subservient place, you mean?
Well, I can't really
What are you guilty of now? I don't know.
the whole mask, the white, it sounds to me, okay, this is, there's a lot of problems in this, and I see them. White male has done this, because I'm a white male, it's partially my fault, and I'm getting the advantages of it. And
right.
I feel guilty about it, and, the pendulum has to swing the other way a little bit farther, and so I don't defend myself, because defending myself would be defending the past of this thing. And also, beyond that, for me to defend myself is not socially acceptable in this type of talk, because I would have all the ooh, male chauvinist.
It's true.
Seriously, I'm not gonna say that.
And you're very sensitive to that because that's the last thing you want to be, based on the way you were raised.
Okay, and then Brent.
This is getting better than Donahue.
That's what I was gonna say.
Brent is our Donahue here.
I don't know what you're saying.
I kind of reacted strongly inside to what you said Tim was saying last night or whatever, where when he's in a room like the blacks or women or whatever, he puts himself lower. And for me, I see that as making the matter worse.
Yes!
For me, I think of the word anti-discrimination. And what you're doing is instead of just saying, I'm okay, you're okay, you know, I used to be turned back 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. You're saying, because I was better and you weren't, now I'm going to reverse it. So I'm worse and now you're better.
What's a word for that kind of
self-deprecation?
Well, but what is it when you become self-deprecating in that situation? You're being patronizing. Mm-hmm. And what patronization is about is that you still fail to accept the fact that you are above, you are in the position of power. So you say, okay, I'm going to take charge of being powerful by making myself be below you. That's the height of, I think that in situations like that, you are who you are. To pretend you're somebody else does nobody any good. And even if what it means is being who you are means you have to bear a degree of responsibility, a degree of flack, or some uncomfortability, you must be who you are. And that was during that discussion, that was part of what I was responding to, too.
Did Tim think he was playing the Jesus model by being lower than
Lord?
I don't know.
Also, Phil, maybe we shouldn't focus this on Tim because he's not really here.
No.
Right.
I can relate because in my dorm, when I was in my freshman year, all of a sudden there were half blacks and half whites. And here we are in the girls' bathroom, right? And we're all brushing our teeth, you know, and here it is in the morning, and one white girl comes up to the bathroom and says, oh, I'm so glad, you know, and puts herself in a very low position. How do you think the black girls responded?
Get out of my face.
You fuck off, bitch.
Can I respond to that?
And so the white girl's trying to be so approachable and so loving and so Christian. And those black girls didn't want that at all.
From personal experience, dealing with people of other races and stuff like that, and just take yourself, you guys can really put yourself in this point. When people play up to you, you just go, don't feed me that shit. You know, you can see right through it. And I mean, the black people that I know and the Asian people and stuff, they, you know, see, you know, when I mean, I haven't told to my face before, you know, you are playing up to me. And that is true, you know, like if I'm scared of somebody, you know, I'll play up to him. And that is seen right through. I mean, not only with racism and stuff, but I mean, I just wanted to comment on that. People can see right through it.
Todd and Tom.
Well, I'm just gonna, race is actually a not the proper concept. We all belong to the human race rather than the deepest African. It's all just, you know, we brought up in different ethnic backgrounds.
Some of which are more primitive than others.
Supposedly, yes.
Can I read a quote here while we're still on this one issue on page 41 at the bottom?
He's asking you, Todd. Okay.
Narcissus, I'm doing it anyway. Narcissus looks at him gravely, Goldman. I take you seriously when you are Goldman, but when you are not always Goldman, I wish nothing more than to see you become Goldman. In terms of any kind of a situation, whether it's in the dorm with blacks or whether it's any other situation, no one's going to take you seriously unless you're being who you are. And if you're trying to resolve a problem, you've got to be taken seriously. It's on the bottom of page 41.
I guess the question I'm getting at, pardon me for interrupting you, Todd, if Lori interrupted you, is what does that do if you are subservient or if you are caring for someone over yourself or if you are not the real you? What does that do to your relationships?
It's being this fake person, and all of a sudden, I don't mean, but it's getting some across. And, okay, anyway, all of a sudden when you realize, hey, I haven't really been the real me, and you form this relationship around the fake you, it's not there. And maybe they call it sometimes a midlife crisis with people or something. I mean, I've seen people call it that. But they don't have anything. So the whole point is you got to be yourself, else nothing's going to hold fast. It's all going to be a waste.
Bingo.
What?
Yeah, all those years I
don't know which one of you guys are first.
No, we didn't. We're still
interrupting. I just got to say, but we got to recognize there's a difference between
servitude and patronizing. Jesus was a servant, but he did not patronize. I mean, he served because that was his call. He was not serving to make anyone feel better. He was serving to be an example. And he was serving because that was what he was called to do. And there are people that can, people can serve without being patronizing, and people can patronize without serving. And people can generally tell the difference, and it's all a difference in your motives.
Yeah. You got it.
Very good point.
You got it for the right reasons.
Tom gets a star.
A heart.
I think Darren.
I wanted to go back on Gloria's comment about guys not wanting to wait, or that thing where she said that the guy wouldn't wait, but the girl would, or whatever. Because I'm not so sure that's true all the way around. I think there are guys that would.
There probably are good men somewhere.
But there are men looking for.
Just a true experience relating to this. My sister's roommate at PLU was accepted to two medical schools, and her husband, she's married to now, was accepted to a dental school, and he refused to marry her if she went to medical school.
Okay, I can
marry him anyway.
or I can give another example. When Susan was married previously, she was accepted into an incredibly wonderful program that was part business and part architecture at McGill University. She speaks French fluently, and it was going to be a wonderful experience. Her husband refused to go there, and so she didn't. It's that same sort of thing. How many house husbands do you know about? How many of us would like to become house husbands, guys? Pardon me? What's a housewife?
Stays home, takes care of the baby. Well, nowadays I see not more a housewife, a house husband, it's kind of like
Or in the Yuppie's case, they sort of hire a wife to take care of.
Yeah, I think we've graduated from some of the house care into who moves for whose career.
That's the
big question. And when do you have the kids, and whose career do you foster first or always?
Yeah.
Well, to clarify that just a little bit more, she's never been in a position to say, will you wait for me? I mean, it's never gotten that far since she started medical school. What I was saying was that she does not have time from her studies to develop an intimate relationship. And guys don't want to postpone. They don't want to date every once every 2 weeks or something.